Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
To the show, everyone, ladies and gents. So we got podcaster Matthew Simpson on here. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Never been bad. So everyone often says never been better. I've never been bad. I've had it good.
Well, it's a blessed life. I'm jealous.
You are one of three contributors on here just talking about the Star Trek reboot. So I just decided all this year we're doing covering the whole Star Trek franchise. Where do you rank here as a fan of that franchise? Like, we just say just you're a casual fan, big time fan.
I am a lifelong Star Trek fan.
Okay, perfect.
You know, there are... If you go on social media, there's lots of people who post about like Star Wars and Marvel, and not enough who post about Star Trek. And I'm the Star Trek. I want to be a Star Trek person. I've been watching Star Trek since I can remember, which is a longer time than I'd like to admit. And I have a Star Trek tattoo. And I've seen every episode of every show. Except for, I guess, Discovery at this point, because it's currently airing. But I've seen every episode of every show, except for Discovery, at least twice at this point.
Sure, for sure.
Not to mention all the movies, which I've seen a probably uncountable number of times.
Perfect. Yeah, we're covering the reboot movies, which currently are at free and has, in the last 2 years, been announced for a fourth one. Which was supposedly by Tarantino, but they passed on that. So, So we've already covered, in short essence, the fan films that happened between the cancellation of Enterprise and, you know, the beginning of these reboot movies. Uh-huh. It was just really interesting how basically both, you know, Viacom's Paramount and the fans are at odds with each other.
Yeah, it's a weird situation in that they're like, they encourage fan films, but not, you can't make money on them, which I guess makes sense from a business point of view, but also,
well, it was dumb because they followed the rules and they still got sued anyway. Yeah, so I think it was just because of that contrarian stance is like, okay, well, first off, Les Moonves was already a terrible guy anyway, like before his scandal. So I wasn't surprised that he was being an impossible to work with presence with the Paramount thing. At the same time, I mean, I respect the fans because they're not going out of their way to just be dicks. They're not like, you know, toxic fandom like you see nowadays with Star Wars or Halloween, where everyone just seems to want to just go on endless rants on social media, you know, and it doesn't change anything. It's like track guys, they can pretty much state their opinion for the most part without being a jerk. And I think the other thing is they just loved it more than like maybe the people they kept trying to get involved with this. And I think what's also unusual is there are a plenty of people involved with the franchise or who are fans who have liked it all. And then there's others who is just like, you know, I cut it off by that point. So I think with this one, it, you know, first you got the first movie and it's basically a Star Wars homage or knockoff. You know, Captain Kirk is a fan, is a farm boy, you know, like Luke Skywalker, and he blows up a giant space station.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek 2009 is an interesting beast to me because it is first and foremost a J.J. Abrams movie, which is sounds like a complaint. It's not exactly, but what I mean to imply is that it lacks a certain depth.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams seems very interested in character that come into places of power but without actually struggling to get to those places, which I think is actually interestingly reflected in both 2009 Star Trek and Force Awakens. So,
oh man, yeah.
And he's really likes asking questions but not really answering them. That's a whole other podcast. So
yeah, because I mean the second film here, Into Darkness, basically just is a Wrath of Khan. It's weird to say. It's like it's both a homage and kind of a knockoff, because it's like all it does is just like do another spaceship takeover and then a reverse who actually sacrifices themselves and then resurrects that character. So it's just like I don't know really what they wanted to do other than that they're clearly huge fans. But
I mean, the thing about Into Darkness is that the fact that Benedict Cumberbatch is playing Khan has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the movie. It's only in there because someone wanted Khan to be. Like, it would actually be a much more interesting movie if he just stayed John Harrison all the time.
If he was just, in general, just an outer space terrorist instead of, oh, by the way, I've been hiding it from you. I am Khan. And
like, yeah, and it, like, at no point does he doesn't act like Khan from this original series or from the rest of Khan. He doesn't ever say his own full name. In the first scene where he does finally say, oh, my name is Khan, like there's no context for that at all.
No,
with the other characters nothing, in this, no. There's no context for the other characters in the scene. It's only there so that people like, you know, in the, like me in the audience will go, oh my God, it's Khan. But it was so out of context and sort of poorly organized that I sort of threw up my arms at that point.
Into Darkness, I remember I said bullshit. I saw it twice in the theater. I'm like, each time, bullshit.
Like, yeah. And the only thing is, like,
there's the rest of the action.
But there's so much potential in that movie to be. There's so many like interesting pieces, especially in the beginning of that movie, that would be so much more interesting to explore. And they just decided to do, well, we got to do Khan. So, and it's just mm-hmm. bad. It's just bad.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, the last one we had, Beyond, you know, I know many were kind of who either had a love-hate relationship with this new franchise. Like, it was kind of wild how people who had never been Trekkies were checking out the classic stuff their parents and uncles had, you know, told them about for years, their friends had talked about, and then they see this new one, Beyond, and it's like the press release was, this is our answer to Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm like, well, why are you trying to be like Guardians of the Galaxy? I mean, that's a whole different, you know, ballpark.
You know, honestly, though, I never made that connection between the two. It makes sense, but I love Beyond. I love Star Trek Beyond a lot. I have exactly okay. one major complaint with it, and that's the way that it ends. I love the tone. I love the it's got a nice level of humor. It looks gorgeous. It's not afraid to be colorful. Like it feels the most Star Trek-y to me.
Really? Okay, interesting. So
except for that one thing about how Edison dies at the end.
Oh, see, I don't even remember that. All I know is that, yes, there's like references to key plot points. You got a bunch of robots attacking them, so it's kind of like an automated version of the Borg. And then they do the Generations type starship separation.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess I have two complaints about Star Trek Beyond. One, I don't think the Enterprise needs to be destroyed so frequently. because it's destroyed in several of the movies. And so at the end of the movie, and this movie came out in 2016, so I don't feel bad spoiling it, but at the end of the movie, the bad guy dies. But the way he dies is trying to complete his plan of like destroying all life in this space
and station. Good luck remembering him. Like, I did not know that was Idris Elba. I was just like, why'd you make him so unrecognizable?
Well, I mean, just because, you know, they wanted him to become more human through the movie, so I get that. But the thing that bothers me is at the end of that, it would be a more Star Trek story if at the end of the movie, when they have their like philosophical confrontation right after they beat the crap out of one another, where Kirk finally gets the other hand and says, no, like we're not made weaker by our differences. We're made stronger by them. And if at that point, Edison or Krall or whatever you want to call him had like had a change of heart and sacrificed himself to stop his own plan, that would have been a more Star Trek ending than him being vented out into space and dying, which is what happens in the movie.
I guess the issue is this movie wants to be deep, but they hired the most, you know, the king of non-deep movies, you know, Justin Lin from Fast and Furious. So I was just like, what does it want to be?
But again, like, I'm fine. I'm like, it's except for that one fumble at the end, I'm basically fine with it. Like, I and all the like ridiculous action stuff in the middle, like, that's all fine. I'm fine with all of it. Like, I really enjoy the motorcycle bit in the middle. I really enjoy the like jumping, spinning beam out sequence at the end of that too. I think it's really, really funny. I think it's really interesting to pair off Bones and Spock for so long. Because, you know, so often it's Kirk and Bones or Kirk and Spock, and you don't, there's not that many where it's Bones and Spock. So I think it's a really interesting dynamic. But yeah, it's just that one moment at the ending for me where it feels very Star Trek-y right up until that moment. In a Star Trek TV series or in a better Star Trek movie, Edison would have sacrificed himself to stop his own plan. Like, he would have turned back to the light, as it were. But, and I know that's kind of a cliche, but also that's Star Trek. So that's, yeah.
All right. Well, interesting. So I really don't even know what they want to do with this by now, because it seems like they got, you know, Star Trek was always going to have different talents involved with it, but it's kind of interesting how all these talents either kind of wanted to do a homage or kind of just go for mindless action. And so I knew off that point, this wasn't going to get all that deep. It was just going to just be pretty much just easygoing entertainment. And now it's like with this fourth one that's they're talking about, I don't even know that they know what they want to do with it now. I'm even surprised Tarantino contributed to it, but yeah. You know, he wants to be deep and also kind of do homages. So I'm just like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I would love to see a Tarantino Star Trek movie. He reportedly loves Star Trek, so why wouldn't I want to see that? I think they've hired. Last time I actually heard, they had still had Noah Hawley, I think, on board to write and direct, and he makes super weird TV, so I'm sort of into that idea. And you said that you don't really know what they want these movies to be, and I don't necessarily need them to know what they want to be ahead of time exactly. You know, the beautiful thing about Star Trek is that it's been running for so long, and it's done so many different things, and they're all Star Trek. So if Holly wants to take it in a totally different direction, or if Tarantino had taken it in a totally different direction, I think that would have been fine.
All right. I guess, what do you think are storylines that they could bring to life in some fashion that would kind of just make everyone happy?
So I might be a cynic, but one thing I've noticed about modern, or at least current, fandoms is that they're never happy. So I hope they just do whatever is artistically in their hearts. I hope that they I hope that they do something interesting. I hope that they subvert some expectations. I hope that they don't just remake a previous movie. I don't really want to see The Wrath of Khan for the 2, 3, 4, 5th time. And you know, if they did choose, if there was like a particular episode of TV that they wanted to, that they loved, or that they wanted to do an homage to, I'd hope they would kind of do what Wrath of Khan did, which was like do a direct sequel to an episode. I think that'd be far more interesting than many of the choices they've made over the past couple of movies, especially.
Okay, cool.
Like, Star Trek fans love the franchise. That's one thing I really actually appreciate about Star Trek, is that Star Trek fans tend to love Star Trek, as opposed to, say, you know, there are definitely more toxic elements of, say, Star Wars fandom these right. days. You know, there's people who claim to love Star Wars who actually seem to kind of hate Star Wars. And you don't really see that with Star Trek. People just
and it's just do. When it's taking up so many clickbait articles, it's like, all right, enough, you know.
Yeah, and again, like the thing about Star Trek, I'll say again, it's been running for so long, and it's been so many things that there's something there for everyone, and I just, you know, I'm just happy when people show up in it. So, you know, and you definitely have your like spur, you know, genre favorites at the moment, like Idris Elba in 2016. But I just want to see everyone in Star Trek. I would love to see someone like Florence Pugh in Star Trek. My biggest thing that I would like to see in the next Star Trek movie is for them not to abandon Jayla as a character. You know, she basically became part of a crew and part of the crew in Beyond, and she's going to Starfleet Academy at the end of Beyond. And I would like to see some
character consistency with that. Okay, so who was that?
Oh shit, what is her name?
You're talking about Sophie Batella's character, so there you go. I didn't even know that was the actress, and I didn't even remember who that character was, so there you go.
Yeah, just like Star Trek has a sort of a history, a minor history of like introducing a supporting character and then that character never showing up again, at least in the movies. And they did it twice in a row. They did it with Alice Eve as Carol Marcus in Into Darkness, and then they did it, and I hope they don't do it with Sophia Boutella in Beyond.
So where can we find you on the web?
You can find me mostly at awesomefriday.ca, and the Awesome Friday Movie Podcast is available on basically every podcasting platform that there is.
Welcome back, ladies and gents. So here I am with Track on Tools, Matthew Kaplowitz. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Anytime. So excited to just kind of have an all-star just get together on the ups and downs of the reboot version of the Star Trek franchise. Set in the Kelvin alternate timeline, it was a success with audiences and half with critics and diehard fans. This is currently a trilogy, and it is that ran from 2009 to 2016 and is set to have a fourth installment. The fourth installment has been in development hell and has a few different various names being attached to it, from the director of WandaVision currently and previously having a script submitted by Quentin Tarantino, of all people. And so just to start off, like I do with every guest, since it just makes for a better conversation when we're talking about like a deep, just nonstop franchise that's much like the Twilight Zone has a different audience every era. Matt, what was your introduction to just deciding you were going to make time for this franchise?
I grew up watching TNG. That was my first Star Trek. And a lot of folks, you know, they go back to the classic times of TOS, but I was, you know, pretty young when TNG came out. So that was my very first Trek. I can actually remember even getting one Christmas the Galoob TNG action figures, which are terrible, but I still love them to this day.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, yeah, you know exactly the figures. Yeah, that's kind of how my fandom began with it. And to be quite honest, I kind of tapped out not too long after that, unfortunately. I didn't really watch a ton of DS9 when it first aired. I watched very little Voyager and really no Enterprise, because I just really wasn't into it at that point. I basically kind of got out of Star Trek fandom, which is interesting now to be revisiting these Abrams movies because I basically haven't seen any of them except for the first one, really. I hadn't really watched them since they first came out. So, you know, doing this episode with you today, it's been kind of fun going back and watching all that stuff because I will catch parts of, like, the 2009 movie on. But, again, this episode has been the first time I've actually kind of rewatched all of them, especially 2 and 3 since then. But to kind of get back to your question, I kind of got back into the fandom in a more serious way probably around, like, 2015 or 20—I can't remember the year because I know I talked about it on my very first podcast episode, but— it was basically a New York Comic Con where I kind of saw a bunch of the Star Trek toys, and I was like, I remember these, and I bought a whole bunch of them for super cheap, and that kind of, like, launched me back into being a more serious Trek fan, so...
Nostalgia, you know, baby.
Exactly, yeah. So that's why I'm also more excited to talk about this, because not just was it my first time reviewing Into Darkness and Beyond since they first came out, but it's also me now being a more serious Star Trek fan and recognizing a lot of things I didn't catch the first time around.
That's so true. I had... Keith M. Cedar of the Trekspert's Roundtable, who had also worked on some of the various, you know, Axanar fan film and related projects, and he would also talk about how he noticed a lot of people who it was kind of like a Mission Impossible kind of thing, whereas like he saw people who were familiar with the new movies who actually, you know, around that same time when that came out, you know, Netflix and Prime and Hulu made all the Star Trek franchise available, you know, on all platforms, you know, years before Discovery came out, you know, just the main five shows. And he knew people who was like, yeah, had those not come out, they would have not known. They just, for whatever reason, they just didn't have know any relative in their family who knew about Treks. And I'm with you. It was always in my life in some capacity. I would always see part of one of the original series era movies. You know, I saw all the movies at a pretty good time when I was getting into basically any special effects franchise. And so I always understood its legacy and just, I would always get even just mild references. Like there are, there are four lights or, you know, there's, oh, a red shirt just got killed. You know, just, it's just unavoidable. There would always be just something to it.
Memes before they were memes.
Oh, absolutely. But before the internet, you could just do a screenshot and everything. Yeah, it's just like just always just certain references and quotes and lines. Just you could tell if someone had actually just was could just word everything word for word. Like if they were overacting in a cheesy B movie, is like maybe they've been studying William Shatner. You would see even just when there was just amusing debates or forums before it got very hostile to what it is today. There would always be at least one person who would do like a, you know, live long and prosper, you know, slogan, you know, or talk like Spock and say, you know, how illogical. And I think when these movies came out, I would start seeing some people like pretend to have always liked Trek and other people is like never had any interest in Trek until then. So then it was kind of interesting seeing some of those people come out of the woodwork and kind of even expose the whole classically bad Star Wars versus Trek debates, and it's like, seriously? I didn't even know that was still going on, you know, unless it's like a deep, deep forum. But yeah, no, these are definitely interesting in that I would even see certain celebrities, you know, with the franchise, you know, applaud it, you know, tip their hat saying, you did a good job portraying my younger self. And then I saw other, you know, filmmakers say, I didn't see the point of those, you know, and but you can kind of tell it had made some kind of impact because, I mean, people would even look for all the Easter eggs in all three of these movies. Like, basically, there's one in the first movie here where they're claiming Archer from Enterprise is now, like, the president or something. in the last movie, Beyond, there's, like, in-shot references to literally all the movies, like a ship separating and everything, you know, like in Generations. And it's, like... Yeah, is so it is very complex in that there's like some ups and downs, but yeah, we'll get into it. So did you see any of these in the theater?
I saw none of these in the theater. I think the very first time I saw any of them would have probably been, I guess, Netflix. I don't think I rented these. I don't think I watched them with anybody. I'm pretty sure I just watched them on Netflix. So, you know, I wasn't really a big enough fan to even go into the theater. And to be fair, like, I'm not really the movie theater going kind of person anyway. I kind of prefer to sit and watch it at home. because I'm the dude that's like looking at it and overanalyzing things, and it's a lot easier to do that at home in the comfort of your own home and not in a theater surrounded by people. So,
Oh yeah, you don't have anyone bringing their crying babies to the theater, and plus you can look at the subtitles, and if you have to take a restroom break or if the movie is just not grabbing you, you waste 10 minutes of your time
yes, God bless the
versus
pause
2 hours.
button.
Yeah, the pause button is king. Yeah, no, so yeah, when 2009 movie came out, it was kind of interesting how it's like this one basically, before J.J. Abrams, I was always ready, pretty much hit and miss on his earlier TV works. I knew many who were obsessed with it and others who would just basically come to work or come to college and basically just vent about how a plot twist had driven them insane on whatever show he was producing or co-writing it. And so this, I pretty much went in just lukewarm. It was like, let's just have fun. And I think the slogan that they had in the poster saying, "This isn't your dad's Star Trek," I'm like, okay, so they're kind of doing the similar marketing campaign that they did with like the new Battlestar Galactica. Is like when that came out, I hadn't seen, any of the original show, but Edward James almost famously did something saying, "Anyone who expects this to be, a cheese fest, get out now." And I think that just kind of, he tricked everyone into checking it out, and then they realized, oh, it's cool, original, new vision. So, that was some interesting how you backpaced yourself there to give some free advertising and make everyone anticipate it. And this one, I guess it kind of did a similar one, just saying, hey, we know it's not going to be the same kind of deal. And at the same time, like, I guess they weren't giving the finger to the purists, but at the same time, they're saying, yeah, don't expect this to be anything at all like this. So I go in, I see all these battles, and then yeah, I start thinking about after fact. It's like, yeah, typically there is kind of like a moral to the story, like in most of these movies, like what can one do to stop others' abuse of power and all that? And it's like, yeah, I didn't have anything. Like, I didn't remember the villain afterwards, and I had fun with the action. And then at the same time, it's like, yeah, why is this so much like Star Wars? Oh, because in this one, Captain Kirk is a farm boy, just like Luke Skywalker, and he blows up a giant space station. So,
Pretty much was Abrams' audition tape for Star Wars. Let's be honest here. It's what it is.
that's essentially what it is. And I saw people who I thought would have even hated it even speak so highly of this one, like Manny Coto, who was like the showrunner on Enterprise and later worked on bigger shows like Dexter and 24. I was like, really? I would have thought most of you guys would have not liked this because it's not deep. But
Well, and I grew up not. I wasn't in that time period where I was watching like TOS when it first came out. Obviously, I'm too young for that. But I did used to watch all the marathons. Like here in New York, we had a channel called Channel 11, WPIX, and that's what it showed all the reruns. And on certain holidays, they would do like big long marathons, multi-day marathons of the original Star Trek series. So, that's kind of like how I got my knowledge of the original series. But going into the 2009 one, I mean, it was honestly kind of refreshing. And again, this is from someone at this point who is not really that deep into the Star Trek fandom, but it was kind of refreshing that they were doing their own thing, and they were right to say it's not your dad's or even your grandparents' Star Trek. It was very different, and of course that ruffled some feathers.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't to the point of like, I was kind of briefly with Star Wars where I knew all the planets and types of spaceships. Although Star Wars, you kind of had a cheating skill just because like there was always all these books and all these unnamed characters all had names. And it's like, track, you pretty much you either knew everyone's name or you didn't.
That's where my
So.
fandom was at that point when, like in the mid to late 90s, early 2000s, I was in the Star Wars fandom, so I know all that stuff too.
Oh, good. I mean, yeah, it for every Tatooine, there's going to be someone. I mean, it was interesting seeing what people actually knew who Boba Fett's name was versus they only knew like the three main characters. And it's interesting how many Stormtrooper jokes you can make, much to the equivalent of red shirts. Yeah, it's cool that there was still kind of marathons going in and out. There was always some channel who had access to older sci-fi shows, and that always prospered because it was just a big Paramount entity. So the way this plot hole all progresses in this first 2009 movie is basically, you know, they show Captain Kirk's father, and then they show Pike, who was like the original captain for two episodes in the original track, being basically a mentor, is how they rewrite it in this alternate timeline. What was your take on any of the casting choices?
I didn't really have any problems with the cast. I think everybody did, honestly, a really amazing job. You know, the hardest thing about when you do a type of movie like this is that it's a reboot. So automatically, you're going to be making comparisons to the original actors, all the original performers. And it's kind of unfair to the cast back then because, you know, Chris Pine, I think, does a really great job. Zachary Quinto is pretty much a perfect Spock. And Carl Urban, like, highly underrated as a McCoy. I think his McCoy is probably the best thing out there. Really, everybody was great. I think just, you know, really the main thing is the fact that just so many people immediately draw those parallels to, like, the original cast. And it's kind of unfair in a lot of ways because it also sets your expectations. It's like you're used to seeing William Shatner as Kirk, so you want Chris Pine to do his Captain Kirk impersonation. But, you know, on the performer side of things, you don't just want to copy and imitate. Now, you know, granted, Carl Urban did, like, an amazing job of really kind of replicating DeForest Kelly as McCoy, but he also did make it his own. So
he was a big fan growing up and introducing it to his kids. But yeah, I mean, it's so true, because it's like, if you want to accuse these of being giant big budget fan films, go at it. But yeah, I can't fault any of the cast, since they're not only having to imitate but try and become the character. And I think most of them are definitely successful. I mean, I was at Wonder Woman with a bunch of friends, and you know, when Chris Pine came on screen, they're like, hey, I didn't know Captain Kirk was in this. So I do think there are points to this to where, like, even though they didn't originate the role, like, they're still associated with it.
They very much did their own things, and they kind of made themselves their own iconic versions, too. That's kind of my thoughts on that.
So, like, we're even to the point where, like, when they got all the other offers coming in, it's like, they would still kind of have that, like, be one of the first titles that showed up on their resume. For a while, it seemed like Zoe Saldana, you know, is like everyone was calling her Uhura. John Cho, he was kind of at the second stage of his career where, you know, he'd already been in every other comedy franchise. And here he is playing Sulu. And now he's getting even more serious roles. And I think this helped him kind of grow as an actor even more. Just like, you know, got to be heroic there. And so now he gets all the serious roles now.
Sulu was a part he definitely needed to kind of break away from all the typecasting he was getting at that point.
Pretty much. And Carl Urban just needed this role because, I mean, he's just been so underrated in so many different movies. And, you know, he's been in Lord of the Rings, for goodness sake. And here he is finally able to be in a giant franchise. And he seems to just, I don't know, be very selective on what projects he does now. And he has that freedom, fortunately. Quinto especially is interesting because, I mean, basically just added the second best known role to his list of credits. And
and he also got to work side by side with Leonard Nimoy, which, you know, really most of that cast can't really say they got to do. They didn't really get to interact much with their originals. I don't know if you ever saw a documentary that William Shatner did called The Captains. Have you seen that?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so for folks who haven't seen it, basically what he does is William Shatner is interviewing all the Starfleet captains that did other shows, and he actually does get to interview Chris Pine. So, I mean, Chris Pine had some interaction with Shatner, but otherwise, you know, really no one else gets to actually interact with their counterparts from the original series except for Zachary S. Spock. So it was pretty cool actually seeing them side by side and sharing the screen together. That part was actually kind of nice, and I know a lot of folks don't necessarily like that part of the film or just like having that throwback to Spock in that, and I guess both films really, but I think it was fine. I think it kind of fit the story, and seeing two Spocks work together side by side, it's pretty cool because you can just see how good of a job that Zachary did do in that role.
Yeah, around that same time, basically every other franchise was just kind of needing that extra bit of help, and there was always that one actor who kind of kept everything running. And so for me, that was kind of just the equivalent of, you know, whoever spearheaded whatever franchise, you know, shows up to mentor the next of kin or whatever. And I mean, X came out the same year as other franchises like Terminator Salvation. I was like, well, you have Arnold, but it's not really Arnold in there. And for me, yeah, it was kind of like with same equivalent here, where it's like, okay, so Spock is in here. He's the one connecting this whole thing, just showing how it's an alternate timeline. And really that second part of the movie kind of just froze it in a totally different loop that kind of makes you just say, hey, you know, I can turn my brain off now and just have a little fun, because it's all just kind of a fun alternate timeline, a mirror universe, if you will, you know?
I gotta tell you, like, rewatching the films especially, it's funny how much I can remember of them, and really, like, the first film in particular, I actually remember really well, like, the first half of it. That part really stands out very vividly in my mind, and I think it's a really great first half of the film, even, I guess you could say, first two-thirds. To me, the movie kind of starts to lose a little bit of its luster once we actually do get to meet Spock. As important as it is and as cool as it was, for me, that's always been the point where it's like the movie kind of, I start to lose a little bit of interest, because now we're kind of rushing to the third act, and the third act is not the best.
I concur, because the main issue is, I don't know if you go by this rule book, would you say a movie is only as good as its villain?
I think in some cases, but, you know,
there's plenty of cases where we don't care and we're like, okay, the character's strong enough and we're cool with them dispatching various masked villains. But yeah, with this one, it's just like, you look at all the deleted scenes, and I still, to this day, do not understand why they decided to delete the villain's backstory.
I think because it's actually not important, because the movie isn't really about the villain. I think that's something a lot of people kind of miss about this film. And, you know, Into Darkness did a little bit better, for sure. They spent more time with the villain, but there's reasons for that. But, you know, in my opinion, for the 2009 Abrams film, the villain's not important. The villain really is only a vehicle to move the plot forward. He serves no purpose. The movie is really about Kirk and Spock and their relationship and the beginning of that relationship. So you could have, it doesn't really need a villain, because the villain, he's just kind of a plot point. And that's kind of how, obviously how he's treated in the film. But, you know, there didn't really need to be an exploration of him. It's not like, you know, this isn't Eric Killmonger from Black Panther. Like, we don't need to get in-depth backstory from him. We just kind of need to know what his motive is, why we don't like him, why he's doing the bad thing. I think we get more than enough about him. But I do agree, he's completely forgettable.
I think that's my problem.
Rewatching the film, like I said, I can remember easily the first, like, two-thirds of the film until Spock shows up and we get to that last act. Because that last act is kind of not good. But, you know, I'm okay with Nero being as lame as he is, ultimately.
Fair enough. I guess my problem is, it's kind of like whenever there's a weak heroine who's basically, you know, just serves as nothing as to be either a body shield or just, you know, be rescued. And it just, when a character becomes a plot device, it just really stands out like a sore thumb from, I can't speak today. It sticks out like a sore thumb to me. And so I just like, you know, I don't,
I mean, I'm kind of making a comparison to Ghostbusters 2016. I don't know if your fans want to hear me mention that, but I'm going to mention it. So I would compare, like, the villain in that movie versus Nero in 2009 Star Trek. Whereas, you know, like, they're both pretty poorly developed, but one of them is far worse than the other, and that would be the Ghostbusters 2016 villain, because he had, like, really no purpose. So I feel like he's more what, kind of what you're talking about. I feel Nero...
Oh, hell, I'll give you the villains in the latest Rambo. They're all just endless cartel people, and you just feel like they're just one giant walking stereotype, as opposed, and I get it, it's an 80s movie, so it wasn't going to be politically correct, but at the same time, I'm like, I'm, you know, I don't need, it's kind of like with the Die Hard sequels, I don't need the next Hans Gruber, I just need someone who just has a cool plan, because you can't top Hans Gruber. So, if anything, just stand out. I mean, like, I thought every season of 24, which Zachary Quinto was in, and fun fact, my brother once walked in when I was watching season three and he's like, that sounds like Spock. I'm like, it is the guy who plays Spock later on. But yeah, all those villains in the strongest seasons stand out because they got very diabolical plans, and you want to see get inside their head eventually, because it's obviously not about just making a political stance, or, you know, someone pay them a giant chunk of money, you know. So I'm with you, the villain, I see why they're minimizing. At the same time, I mean, I would have just liked more than just, you know, rawr, you know, it just, I would have rather just no scenes with him at all, for that matter. Just like, just go to the next wave of just nonstop, you know, villains. And I will commend the music score, Michael Giacchino's score, I think is marvelous. It pretty much
score is stellar, yeah.
And I think he does a good job on pretty much all these. He's just I wasn't familiar with his TV work, ironically. I had first come to knowing about him by playing Call of Duty. So I was just like, okay. So he kind of does a mixture of kind of John Williams and Alan Silvestri kind of scores is how I'd liken it. There's always little touches where I'm like, okay, that's a Superman score. Okay, that's a Predator kind of score. Okay, cool. I'm with it. How would you describe, I guess I'll, so let's talk about the infamous lens flare.
The lens flare, yes.
You can't not talk about it. So I don't have sensitive eyes, and I kind of understood why they were doing it at first when they were like traveling, like on the space shuttle, you know, Bones and Kirk are going to Pike's ship. And then after a while, yes, after a while, especially on a rewatch, it was like, why is this flowing, you know, so much? You know, everyone varies in what annoys them or what doesn't annoy them. I'm not annoyed by like shaky cam because I'm just used to like the camera shaking, especially on Star Trek, you know, when that's how they made it look like the ship was being bombarded in addition to the actors, you know, falling on the ground. But every edit can go over the top in some cases. And there's plenty of times where someone seems to be just, you know, using a steady cam and just not stabilizing it fully. And it just feels awkward, but yeah, the lens flare just seems like, you know, as the filmmaker was quoted, is like, it's the only thing I knew how to breathe life into the scene for. I'm like, for real? That was the upside. Only one.
The upside is that there was a lot less lens flare in the second, and by the third, it was practically gone because they really weren't even on the ships that much. So.
That's what's so wild. I would get into arguments with people who swore there was way more in the second one. I'm like, I think you're just misinterpreting your disgust in the movie with there being more lens flare. I mean, there was even a video on YouTube that showed there was way more lens flare in the first one.
Yeah, there's no debate. I mean, I just watched them back to back. Anybody who says otherwise is a fool. That's all. They need to just go watch them again. It's pretty noticeable. There's no way around all that lens flare in the first film. It is obscene, but it wasn't as distracting as I remembered it being now. Like, I remember when it first came out, I didn't like it either, but I feel like, you know, the visual language of the film, and don't get me wrong here, I'm not defending the lens flare. I don't think it's a great choice, but I guess the visual language of the film was that this isn't your dad's Star Trek. So the way they did that was by making things move constantly, and there's so much more tension and running around. It's a lot less calm than any of the previous Star Treks you've seen at that point. So one of their ways of injecting more energy into it would be that lens flare, as obnoxious and annoying as it was.
Just being frantic, frantic, frantic. And
because it really is. I mean, like we said earlier, it's basically J.J. Abrams' audition tape for Star Wars. So Star Wars is a world that's constantly running around and moving. Star Trek is typically not. Even in the most tense scenarios, I mean, they're always usually pretty calm and level-headed, even really when they shouldn't be. But, right. You know, in this time around, in 2009's film, like, it's all about high-octane action. Everything is moving. There's people running around. Like, how rare is it that on a Star Trek show you see them running to the engine room or running to the bridge room? Like, no, they don't do that. They just calmly, politely walk over there and, yeah. But here in Abrams, I mean, they're running around. There's so much more fuel going on in this film, so the lens flare is hideous, but I guess that's part of the reasoning for it. That's kind of my thoughts on why it even exists, really.
I guess so. I think he went into just overdrive, no pun intended, just summing up
drive.
Urgency. Yeah, warp.
This is a Star Trek show.
Yeah. So yeah, I think we're all pretty much just like, just the cast had charisma, and even just seeing their earlier roles. I mean, Zoe was used to being as part of an ensemble. She had a brief part in the early Pirates of the Caribbean. And again, Carl Urban was on Lord of the Rings and a bunch of other campy shows. So it's like everyone was used to being part of an ensemble. And I guess I always used to kind of find Chekhov just kind of questionable, sometimes even annoying in some episodes. And I felt like Anton Yelchin was like, I'm, you know, Russian, so I'm going to just do my most over-the-top version of the Russian accent, and that's summing up Chekhov.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned is like how a lot of these folks were doing ensemble parts, and that's kind of true to the original series, too. I mean, if you really look at it, like, Shatner, at the time, he was a leading man, but guys like Leonard Nimoy, like DeForest Kelly, they were usually more character actors. Same thing with Walter Koenig. George Takei, of course, mm-hmm. you know, being an Asian American in Hollywood in that time period, you weren't going to get much to begin with. So a lot of these guys were coming from ensembles. They weren't really super well known yet. And Star Trek is kind of what helped propel their careers. And I think we could say safely that, you know, 2009's film, you already had some people who were established stars, but there were plenty of others who weren't. And this film really helped them get things moving along. Like we mentioned John Cho too, like this kind of helped change the trajectory of his career. I think we can say that about a lot of the people who appeared in this film.
Oh yeah. He's just fabulous. And I mean, it just a total step up from being, you know, part of the duo of Harold and Kumar, or just, you know, the perverted guy in American Pie's franchise. So it's like, yeah, here he had to actually be athletic and play around with, you know, a samurai sword. It's kind of the first time we really even see Sulu actually be in a more action-packed way, as opposed to, you know, in the movies, he's just the guy who, you know, gets to fire the torpedoes. You know?
Yeah. I mean, at least you have Captain the Excelsior in Star Trek VI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then at that point, he's yelling fire. And, yeah, so seeing him on, movie
that
six.
Kind of goes back to my point, though, too, how, like, all those Star Trek movies, we're talking about some action sequences, and they're still pretty quiet, comparatively speaking. That really is, like, the biggest thing that stands out to me about all the new Star Trek films, and especially 2009, is just how much more stuff is constantly happening and buzzing around on the screen.
Yeah, no shortage of it. It's interesting how some people likened it to being a Spielberg approach, and others, you know, criticized it, saying it felt more like a Roland Emmerich or Michael Bay kind of mindless fest. So it's just like, it's that weird gap where somehow this movie has elements of all those filmmakers, and yet was for the most part a mixed to rather, you know, highly applauded effort. And yet here we are talking about it now, and there's stuff in it that still hasn't aged well, and yet it's kind of still pretty watchable out of all of these three. So it is an odd case to make when it's just like there's some good, and yet there's some stuff not so good. So where do we rank it? You know,
I mean, I can tell you for my part, the 2009 film is an easy watch. Honestly, like it's a summer popcorn flick. That's what it was meant to be. That's kind of how I view it. It's always easy watching. I could turn it on, see it on TV, and it's just like it's easy to just jump in at any point and just get into it. And I don't know if we want to start ranking things too early on in this episode here, but like, it's hard to say which one I like more, honestly, because I actually really like Star Trek Into Darkness. I'm surprised how much I like it. I mean, but on the other hand, I know a lot of folks who love Star Trek Beyond, and I found that one to be the worst, and like I just don't like that one really that much at all. not as bad as I first remember it, but I'm really not a fan of that one as just even as a movie. But Star Trek Into Darkness, good film, and 2009, it's pretty darn good.
Totally with you. So I guess we're both in agreement. You know, watchable, 3 out of 5. It may not be an actual Star Trek film, but it is, like you say, watchable popcorn.
Well, that's kind of the thing, is I feel like this also began the conversation of what is Star Trek, and we were already getting those conversations earlier, really, to be honest. You know, when Star Trek TNG first came out, there was loads of complaints about that. The fans had rebelled on it before the first episode even aired.
Mm-hmm.
When DS9 came out, it was the same thing. There was all sorts of stuff. There was all the political talk about it. Same thing with Voyager. Pretty much anytime there's anything new Star Trek, there's just like one old guard of fans who don't want it to change. And 2009 and all the Abrams Trek movies, they just completely flipped the franchise on its head. And I don't think any franchise is a monolith. That's my controversial opinion. I don't think any franchise is a monolith or should be a monolith. They should all have their own voice and stand up on their own. And that's what I think 2009 did, and kind of led the way for what's going on now. Whether you like it or not is a story for another episode, maybe. But
no, that is a good segue, because it's like prior to this, I did see a lot of filmmakers and even producers note like this opened the way to doing reboots, because for a while it was just the remake machine, and then, you know, Batman Begins comes out, so then every superhero movie not only wants to be like it, but then even just in general, like everyone was like, we got to do a similar kind of gritty style to kind of Christopher Nolan that he does in all his mystery movies. So it was kind of interesting how, yeah, this one was like the next phase where just, you know, this even came out the same year as District 9. And I saw a lot of people kind of trying to imitate that. It's like, do a movie that's heavily inspired by like earlier 80s and 90s blockbusters like Terminator and Blade Runner or Aliens, and then kind of just find your own voice using that similar visual medium and advertising.
That's kind of what you have to do. I think like you can take inspiration from the older stuff, and you should take it and respect it and treat it accordingly, but you also still need to modernize things. Like I hear people all the time talk about how like Orville is the best Star Trek out there right now. And I really disagree with that statement. I have not finished the Orville still. I'll be full disclosure here. I've been watching it here and there. I don't really like it. I'm just kind of watching it to see how it goes. And I've had to watch it for research for certain episodes of my podcast because I had guests on who appeared in it. But you know, like to me, the Orville is like 90s Star Trek, kind of just rehashed, but with Seth MacFarlane jokes, which usually don't land for me, not as much as they used to. So, you know, I'm kind of happy bringing things into the modern world a little bit, as much as other fans. They still want it to be, you know, 1990 Star Trek, but we're not in the 90s anymore, and things have changed. The world has changed. Obviously, visual effects has changed. Acting theory has changed. Like, so much has evolved. You know, like you're not gonna get the same movies you got back then. You know, there's all these people who will say, you know, movies kind of peaked in the 70s. And that's when really I think acting kind of changed in a lot of ways too. But you know, it's always it's a generational kind of thing, I guess. It's kind of what I'm getting at here is it's a generational thing. No one's gonna ever be
Oh,
happy. They always
totally.
want it to be their memories of the thing. But I think and you know, to kind of bring it back to Star Trek, when I first saw the films in 2009, I remember comparing them a lot to the original series and just being really kind of obsessed with that, even though my knowledge of it wasn't even that necessarily great. But I was like, well, you know, Kirk was his version of Kirk was okay, I guess, but watching it today now again, I don't really care as much, I guess, how quote unquote Star Trek-y it is. I like what they did with it. I like that they took a risk, and I think in the case of the Abrams films, I think they worked for the most part.
Yeah, no, that's so true, because like this is kind of the equivalent of basically like when there's a book adaptation of a movie, like, you know, in the 90s Michael Crichton was hot, you know, and then there was like James Patterson was tempted at a few different times before then it basically went to just anyone who made the New York Times bestseller list basically got a movie offer. And so it is like, but almost every time, you know, it's not going to be at all like the book, because, you know, when there's so many creative people involved, there's going to be a sacrifice that's going to be made. And I've even had to tell people before, especially on script to screen type exercises, is like, you know, a book chapter is going to take up like 5 to 10 pages that would read as just static or just uninteresting on a movie visual medium. You know, you got to have all these various shots and stuff to choose from to keep the pace going. And yeah, no, I mean,
And that's why they call it adaptation, right? It's not like, you know, it's gonna be not gonna be a word for word verbatim kind of thing. It's an adaptation of something that's out there.
And really, the only time it's compromised is when it just feels like no one had any vision at all and they just did like a copy and paste. And it's just somehow still tone deaf, even though it's trying to stay true to whatever author's intent. And I think, yeah, pretty much they just, all these fanboys who were bigger fans of movies but more Star Wars people basically just said, let's just do whatever we want to do. And yeah, it's can be enjoyed as just a standalone sci-fi versus, you know, whatever you want it to be. And
I think
so.
for sure that's kind of what Star Trek did too, because I remember at the time a lot of folks, actually you said this earlier, how you know, a lot of folks were coming out of their Star Trek fandom, if you will. So folks who weren't necessarily into Star Trek before because it was maybe too nerdy or even too intellectual, perhaps in some levels, they just didn't like it as much as Star Wars, whatever the reasons were. The 2009 film got them interested in Star Trek again, and it did very much revive the entire franchise, not just the 2009 version of it.
Yeah, because I mean, even before I found out, just kind of killed a lot of the creativity in the room. It's just like, I would see some people say, oh, give the franchise back to Rick Berman. I'm like, guys, he's not even a writer. He's just the guy who, you know, funded the whole. Oh, lost you there for a minute. Can you hear me now?
Yep, I'm back.
Okay, yeah, I don't know what happened. But yeah, no, it was basically, you know, Rick Berman was just the guy who just, you know, would pitch the shows and assign who was going to be the lead writer and everything. And I think his issue was he oversaturated the franchise because he didn't want to, you know, lose the rights to it. But that kind of worked against it because then, you know, the DS9 and Voyager guys had to work extra harder to stand out, you know?
Very much so. Yeah, and that's kind of how I guess it should be though. Like, you know, all the shows should kind of stand out on their own, and that's what they kind of did. They had to do that. Like I said, no franchise should be a monolith. So while Star Trek TNG is one thing, DS9 was a completely different thing as well. And yeah, that's probably my favorite of all the series. But you
Any
kind of do need
original
to be
sci-fi
different.
show often would struggle to differentiate itself from being called a Star Trek or even an X-Files knockoff, like Babylon 5 had that issue for season.
Yeah, that's what happens when shows trying to find their legs. I mean, they're trying to find their way to stand out. They need to figure out that language for themselves, and ultimately they either get there or they don't, and they fail. But if they
Right.
do take the risks and they make it work, then they become a success.
Essentially. And so yeah, how about we move on to Into Darkness? So basically this is a Wrath of Khan rehash, but in an alternate timeline. And you go the whole movie saying, maybe this guy is or isn't Khan. But I don't know why it was really a mystery when they kind of revealed it in the trailers. I
They
am
well, for a
Khan.
while they didn't. For a while it was a mystery in those trailers, and I remember like hoping and praying it was gonna be someone different, because I mean really we knew it was gonna be Khan, but I was like, what if it was an evil mirror version of like Picard? How cool would that have been?
Oh, yeah, it would have been way better. Or even just, I don't know, just some, super smart terrorist. And basically, yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch, I think the main issue is that everyone's like, yeah, he's not Latino, and Khan was kind of Latino. But I think the other thing issue is Star Trek was never really wrote what race each of its characters was. It just
Well,
always
Khan was actually. Khan was supposed to be Indian.
okay, so
His
there you
full name
go.
was Khan Noonien Singh, so he was always meant to be an Indian, but he was played by Ricardo Montalban, who's Hispanic.
Oh, so some pretty confusing
I mean, it
casting
was the
all.
60s, and back then you were going to be hard pressed to actually find authentic people of that color on screen doing that kind of role. I mean, we're not that many years apart at this point. If we're going back to original Star Trek and Ricardo Montalban as Khan, we're only a few years away from the Kung Fu series casting David Carradine and completely forgetting that Bruce Lee existed. So that was kind of just unfortunately the times.
The times, baby. They did not age well, and they
Yeah, and
were
that's
wrong to
why they
begin
kind of
with.
changed Khan completely in Star Trek Into Darkness, and they kind of kill any part of him that might be Indian whatsoever, just turn him completely into Anglo-Saxon.
Pretty much. It's kind of wild how in this one, I mean, they talked about Khan's people and Enterprise and their origin. And with this one, it was kind of more, he's got all these like clones and other hybrids that are like frozen. They keep the whole supernatural strength element, but pretty much the most tired part. I mean, I've seen Benedict Cumberbatch do impersonations of Alan Rickman in interviews, so I wasn't really surprised that when it's basically what he does here. He's a Steve voice,
Like I enjoyed him, but he's definitely kind of weak here, and it's not really his fault of his own. It's more just what he has to work with, and I think he made like the best out of what he had for sure. But I
Yeah,
feel
he's
like
really the
Khan
highlight for
was,
me because basically, like you say, it's just a trashy role and he's
yeah,
just hamming it up.
like he had stuff to say. It's just wasn't really the greatest stuff to say, unfortunately. And Khan, it was kind of an interesting role because I think we're. You alluded to Batman earlier in like the reboot of Batman with Chris Nolan. I don't remember the year that Into Darkness came out, but I'm trying to remember like how close it was.
2013. I saw it twice in the theater and it was one of those kind of the same kind of deal every time. Just couldn't take my eyes off the screen because of the action. And yet each time I would kind of just also roll my eyes at how there was just so many unrelated segments that don't have anything to do with the main part of the plot, what little there is. Like there's a, we start off with a get a away team mission that doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie. Then we got the scientists and other intrigue that really you could have deleted and nothing would have changed. And then a twist on the, instead of Spock sacrifice himself, Kirk sacrifice like tries to sacrifice himself to save Spock. And it's like, that's just so weird.
I mean, I
Doing
feel
a
like I'm
twist
about
of
to
a
piss off
twist.
like all your listeners, but that's actually the way you describe it is kind of how I felt when I first saw it when it first came out. And then rewatching it now, I was like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, the opening gambit is that. It's just that's what it is. Just kind of get you to hook yourself into the watching the film, whatever. But I was like actually impressed how much the movie set up everything this time around. And granted, it's like a little clunky at times. Like I remember when I first watched it, spoiler alert, I the tribbles are kind of an important thing in this film, and so is the blood of Khan. And I didn't realize like they actually set up Khan's rejuvenating blood right from the beginning. It just never occurred to me because it happened so early on. I just didn't care, I guess, when the movie first came out. I wasn't that observant. But I feel like things were really set up better than I remembered, and that's a good thing. And again, I feel like while the movie is about Khan and Khan is the villain or whatever, I think the story is still very much about Kirk and Spock's relationship, and Khan is just kind of a vehicle to push that together.
Oh, their
And
seeds are definitely strong, especially when they're I'll at least commend the movie for the going ship to ship in outer space and having to trust Khan against all, you know, logic.
Like, they're definitely developing the villain a lot more. They basically heard the complaints of the first film and said, all right, we got to make a well-rounded character here. And they did that. Yeah. I think.
And then, you know, Peter Weller is being villainous as a Starfleet guy. Is like, wow, interesting. He's a traitor, and then he's getting mauled to death because he's like supervised the Khan program in some capacity.
Like, it's actually kind of cool. You know, they brought up Section 31 and how the augments came to be. So it's kind of cool. They're setting things up. They're making it more complicated. And like, what I was getting to was, you know, in terms of like what year it came out was, I'm trying to remember if this like overlapped when The Dark Knight came out, because
yes, it did. Dark Knight had come out in 08, and basically, much like James Bond was kind of trying to have all its villains kind of be big bads like that, this was kind of doing that same thing. And
yeah, Dark Knight Rises, they were really going out with that high intrigue kind of route with Khan here, and it totally works. Again, it's not your typical Star Trek movie, but it's really good what they did here. And it's also really cool just how they continued to build the Kirk and Spock relationship, which we do kind of ignore a little bit, I think, in the third movie. But, you know, they're really building on it, and they're building on the importance of Star Trek II and that relationship that they had in the original Star Trek 2, I should say, to clarify that. So they were doing that, but they were, again, flipping it on its head, trying to do their own thing with the roots of Trekdom. So mm-hmm. I give them credit for it, and I think it worked still. I still think it's really good. Like, I have a hard time discerning if I actually like Into Darkness more than 2009. I think I like 2009 more, but it's pretty close for me, which I'm still surprised.
I definitely appreciate, the ideas and the buddy elements are strong. It's just kind of all the in-between stuff that's pretty sloppy. But yeah, the action is very cool. And I know many people argue about it more just because they hate the lens flare this time around. I pretty much just enjoy how Kirk is getting back to the whole hand-to-hand fighting, and Spock is having to do more than just read off scientific lines and, you know, take out a phaser every 5 seconds.
We haven't mentioned yet the fact that Spock has a romantic relationship with Uhura. Like, that's actually a pretty big thing too, that he's actually doing that. And they're fleshing out the character of Spock much more than he ever really got fleshed out in the original series. And even like in the movies, he got his time to shine. I mean, he got killed, he got resurrected, and then he had to basically figure his life out again. But it was more of like a plot device in a lot of ways. Here, like, he's actually building a character more so than just being a Vulcan. Like, being the alien species is what he kind of was. Here in the Abrams films, like, he's an alien being, but they've also injected, I think, a lot more humanity into his character, and that makes him much more relatable too.
Yeah, they definitely embrace the whole, you know, half human, half Vulcan way more this time around. I mean, when they first announced Picard and saying how, you know, if Romulus was actually the planet was actually destroyed, I'm like, okay, so interesting how you're tying that all back in again. But they kind of downplayed it when it actually premiered. I was like, well, interesting. You got some of these same people associated with it. And I think some Trek fans were more hard on this just because they got into a pissing match with Roberto Orsi, who kind of told him to fuck off. And I was just like, at the same time, I would have probably said the same similar thing. It would have been like, if you don't like it, don't watch it. But at the same time, I mean, it's just complicated because he's like, he's a fan, but yet there are also fans complaining. So it's just like, they should have just, I don't know. Someone should have figured out the HR and said, don't reply to this, you know, these comments until you're ready. You know,
I mean, for a lot of folks, Star Trek is a way of life. It's not just a fandom to enjoy. It is their life. I'm not really a Star Trek purist. I'm obviously a pretty huge Star Trek fan if I'm doing a podcast all about it. But I'm not like one of the purists that's going to get like super picky over things. But yeah, if you got someone who's basically talking down to the fans, I mean, that person's kind of a jerk. So yeah, forget that dude.
Yeah. And I think he kind of got dismissed after that. They're like, okay, after this, let's, you know, change up the writers. Alex Kurtzman, I notice, has been kind of, fans have been complaining about him. He's always kind of been just kind of a, you know, take one for the team kind of guy. And I gave him the benefit of the doubt when I read how, you know, he was set, you know, he had directed all these other indie films, including one with Chris Pine, and he basically got that awful, you know, Mummy remake taken over by Tom Cruise. So, you know, he still had to put his name on it at the end of the day, even though, you know, he got overridden by the own star. So I think he's, you know, he and Gene Roddenberry's son, you know, have both just kind of said, hey, we're just going to just Star Trek is once again going to get oversaturated, but this time we're going to just make it to be, make sure they're even more and more different. So if you don't like this, you can at least appreciate this other one. You know, if you don't like Picard, you can watch Discovery. If you don't like Discovery, you can watch Lower Decks. If you don't like that, you can watch Prodigy. You know,
yeah, there are a lot of choices now. They're all pretty different.
Pretty ballsy to say you hate all of these, because I mean, when they've even brought back some of the same cast and crew, you got to wonder how arrogant some of these fans are to just not like any of these.
So I mean, a lot of fans, they kind of just want Trek the way it used to be, and that's, you know, like we talked about earlier, that's kind of just what they want. They want Trek to be what it was in the 80s, 90s,
which and, is, you know, like, impossible.
How it's just simple, short moral plays. But you know, the times have changed. The issues have become more complex here in 2022. So
I mean, movies aren't even made the same way. So it's like,
exactly, everything's changed. Yeah. You can't make a movie in the 60s the way it was made in the 60s anymore, because we're not living in the 60s. So, you know, again, the Star Trek purists want their own thing, and they want it to be what in their mind is this virginal vision of Star Trek. Star Trek is the monolith to them, but I think, you know, Star Trek has always been about the future, looking forward to the future, and also still at the end of the day, let's get real here, it's a product.
It's a product, as cold as it is to say. Progressive product, and it should do more than just make you feel good. You should also, I mean, I take it you've seen the documentary that talked about how Uhura actress Nichelle Nichols was a big icon of NASA, even helping fund some of their projects, you know?
Yep.
So it's just like, without any kind of positivity or inspiration, it's already not Star Trek. So it is kind of complex, because we can say these aren't really Trek movies, but at the same time, there's a different kind of popcorn all the same, you know, that you're not getting what you get from like some of these other more, you know, better known, more popular, or even forgettable blockbusters. With these, you're pretty much just, it's a giant roller coaster ride from beginning to end. And I'd even probably use the Captain Power comparison, where it's just like, you know, that was produced by a theme park production company. And it's like, this is kind of what it is. It wants to be a theme park attraction.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, I think we can say the same thing for another Star franchise too. Star Wars is kind of the same thing. It's very self-aware that it's hooked, and I think sometimes the fans kind of forget that it's a product too. Now, don't get me wrong, they have every reason to not like something. That's totally their prerogative, and you know, I'm not picking fights over that. I feel like I have the unpopular Star Trek opinion here. But
it seems, you know, like it's hard to state happen. Any opinion without everyone just like, they got this prejudged concept. And I mean, I was even talking with Keith when we did our episodes. There's some people who still want to go by the odd number rule. I'm like, it still doesn't add up. That doesn't add up, regardless of whether you consider Galaxy Quest as canon. I mean, because people like Star Trek Free at the time, and it's like, come on, you know. When we get to Beyond, so I was in the theater. I saw all these in the theater, and this was the only one where we didn't have, there weren't many people in the afternoon screening, and both I started taking out my phone. I just said, fuck it. It's just like, this isn't even a Friday or Saturday morning movie. This is a Sunday night movie where you just want something going on, but you really aren't intrigued at all by the lazy plot. And so I kind of just knew I wasn't going to really dig it, because unpopular opinion.
So I'll put it to you this way. I was watching all these films again, obviously, for this episode. And I watched 2009 one first. I watched them all chronologically. Logically. So 2009, I think I took like one or two bathroom breaks, because they're long movies. So, you know, I did that. Long. Otherwise, easy to sit through. I got into Darkness, and that required a little bit more pausing. I got to Star Trek Beyond, and that's like 2 hours, right? For me, it was about 4 or 5 hours, because I had a real hard time sitting around watching it. I had to take big breaks. It just was not too interesting for me. And you know, I will say I actually like it more than I did the first time I saw it, too. I think I really kind of hated it the first time I saw it. Watching it again now, many, many years later, I can kind of see what they're going for. And I think it also helped the fact that I did just binge the other two movies right before this. So I kind of watched it as, you know, I guess you could say a three-part story. And it kind of made a lot more sense watching everything back-to-back. And it was also nice that there's really no introductions this time. Like, we're just going right into the story. There's no time wasted here. There's no wasted motion. But you know, one of the criticisms you'll hear of a lot of TNG's Trek movies is how it felt like a longer episode. And that, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not really a great thing either. And Star Trek Beyond felt like a long episode that just didn't want to stop and just kept going and insisting on itself. And And then the Beastie Boys happened. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely an unusual predicament, whereas like they're having a lot of modern day music playing on here. They've always been kind of obsessed with playing Beastie Boys in the promos, and then here they are actually playing it in the movie. I didn't know what to expect from this. I guess my issue is don't get all these various giant actors. Like, they got one guy, Ray, they had the Sophia Batia gal from Elba under a bunch of, you know, heavy makeup, and I just found the whole thing just very forgettable. I find it watchable, forgettable, but it's just, I don't know. I just really am tuned out because, like, with this one, I just had zero themes to comprehend or think about. And I know many tracks guys who don't care for a lot of Transformers, Fast and Furious type stuff, and they like this a lot just because, for whatever reason, just the pop culture references and just other inside Easter eggs were enough for them. So I guess to each their own. I just can't even tell you what the plot is. And I know, you know, others have explained it to me, and I'm just like, but if I'm just not really all that into it, you know, and it, I don't comprehend it for the most part, I can't say it's an involving or engaging plot.
I mean, we kind of go back to what we were saying about the villains and how like important they should or should not be. And this, in this case, the villain is like super duper important to the entire progression of the film, but he is utterly forgettable, utterly useless, and just really not a good character.
Don't even remember what alien race they are, you know?
They made one up for him, basically. I mean, Idris Elba did what he did. He did the best he could, but oof, was he basically swimming upstream in this one. He was just not a good character. No fault of his own. Again, he did the best job he could, but yeah, as far as like villains go, I mean, this is the movie now that actually... We could even compare it to Star Trek 3 maybe a little bit, because Krug was so super important in that one.
As his nemesis, even though, you know, that was made knowing that to begin with, so at least be amused by Track 5 in a cheesy way. But at the same time, yeah, it's not a perfect movie. And Nemesis, you know, it might work as, you know, a Data movie, but I'm just so annoyed by the Picard clone subplots and the unnecessary Matrix, you know, like edits. To where that's kind of why it lost some of its fan base. And it also just came out in a year which was already oversaturated with other, you know, 2002 blockbusters. So yeah, with this one, I kind of felt much of the same, where it's just like, it's just so much fed to you right up front. It's like eating, again, you know, fast food, and then just feeling like after all was said and done, it was still a pretty forgettable fast food.
I think it's a great comparison to make with Nemesis, in fact, because that's kind of what I thought of when we have the stupid motorcycle scene towards the climax of the film.
Yeah.
With Chris Pine on the motorcycle. I'm like, oh, good. It's like Nemesis when they got out the little Jeeps or whatever they had, the little quads. Mm-hmm. Because I hate that scene. It didn't belong then. It doesn't belong now.
And you watch it on TV, and every time it's just like, just killing time here, guys. You know, we're already 20 minutes into this. And we've had the wedding reception and everything, and we need to actually know what the hell is going on here. You know, he kept us in the dark for too long, and you lost half the audience. And it's like, it feels like that was just, you know, like you say, with Nemesis, that felt like that was there to just wake everyone up. But all it did is just add more confusion for those who really were intrigued. And yeah, with this, it's like doing a tribute to that. And at the same time, it's just frustrating you, because it's like, can we get off the damn planet already and just, you know, stop whoever, you know, Star Trek 6 style from being assassinated in Starfleet. You know, it's taking way too long. So it's
like, there's a lot going on, but absolutely none of it is memorable.
Yeah. And I know some people who do swear by this one, and I don't get it, but it's like the only one I just cannot, like, I have even forced myself to try and come back and watch it, and I can't do it. I literally cannot do it. There's just some movies that are impenetrable. The most I can give this one, you know, like the first two, I can give a 3 out of 5 because they're just worth seeing, pros and cons and all. And this one is, there's so many cons to where it just feels like such an empty movie. And like you say, the idea is explored and the camera work is great, but it's just like, in fact, this time you really don't even see any outer space battles. It's all them stranded on a planet. But I mean,
well, we actually get 2 space battle kind of things, but that's how forgettable they are, is you forgot about them happening even.
Yeah, so yeah, I get that there's a bunch of drones and everything that attack them and them dividing the planet. But yeah, when you're just reminded of other movies. That's just how unengaged I am. It's exactly what issue I had with some of the other Star Wars movies, where it's like, okay, I like Rogue One's homages and I didn't like the homages in the other ones. So it's like, I thought it worked in The Mandalorian, for instance, just some of the shots by shots, because that was just like, it felt complimentary. It felt like an add-on because it already had the stuff. So they were free to do, it had the other stories down to a T, so they were free to do what they want and add their own, you know, love letter. And at this point, this, you know, you had people who didn't, you know, who aren't concerned with really any kind of story or coherence. They're just kind of, they just want to just have a reason to basically let the actors do whatever the hell they want. Some of it feels ad-libbed and other stuff just feels like it's just there to, again, just get to the next scene. And when you get that too workmanlike or that mechanical, even if I didn't have a phone, my brain would just be elsewhere. You know, I don't go to sleep during movies. My brain just wanders. I just become disengaged. Just like when any of us see like a award-winning movie that's, you know, dominated the Oscars, and then lo and behold, we see it and we're just unimpressed and we're like, what was the fuss all about? Why did everyone want to bid on this as best picture or what have you? And that's kind of where I was with that, where it's like, well, it's watchable, but again, I just
there's a lot of better ways you could spend 2 hours on watching Star Trek Beyond.
Totally. And you know, eventually, if you're just waiting for a movie to end, you know, that's also not a good thing. And I really do try to be considerate. Like, there's plenty of movies I don't care for, but if I find it watchable or something in it that I can recommend to other people who I think will like it, I'm still going to give it a 3 or 3.5 out of 5, you know? You got to be fair. And this one, I struggle to even give it a 3. And it's like, yeah, no, pass. Just, this is Monopoly, but you do not pass go. You do not collect $100.
Yeah, no, this is, I would watch it is because I had to do this podcast, and I will never watch it again if I have my way.
It can be erased for time. This is the alternate mirror universe you don't need to go to.
But I am happy I did get to revisit Into Darkness and the original one again, because those, I think, I feel like they hold up better now, because like I said, like last time I saw these, I wasn't really as into Star Trek as I am today, and watching them now as the fan too, it's like I can appreciate the fan service more, of course, that's more helpful, but I think I just have more of an appreciation for them as a whole, and I feel like they were all, with the exception of Beyond, they were all fairly respectful of the source material.
Totally. Or at least just feeling free to do whatever they wanted, even though, you know, some of the people involved were fans and others weren't, is like, you at least knew what they wanted to do, which was be just a summer blockbuster, which is what the original movies were, basically. You know,
that's all they were, really. They were basically there because Star Wars did really well in the theater, and Star Trek wanted some of that sweet, sweet money, too.
Mm-hmm. I got to say, the visual effects and all of them are pretty good. It's interesting how I've been really disappointed by some of Industrial Light and Magic's more recent effects. They come a long way, and there are times where I'm like, I would have never known it was by them. That just looks like such forced computer graphics, whoever was doing it. And these, I definitely don't think they skim out on them at all. I think they do, especially considering the fact that they abandoned the whole doing model work and everything is all digital models. And
yeah, a lot cheaper that way.
A lot cheaper, but I mean, so much detail on those spaceships. And
I'll always prefer physical models over the CGI stuff, but I mean, it still looks pretty good, and I mean, I think here's like kind of the controversial question. Did you actually like how the Enterprise looked?
You know, I didn't even think about that, because, I mean, it is, basically, it just kind of, it feels like it goes with the rest of the sets. I'm definitely impressed by the film sets, because basically, you know, you got a lot of silver, and then you got a little bit of red glowing, and then the only, you know, real thing that connects it to anything track related is just the, you know, classic series, you know, door opening sound effect, and that's it. You know, you don't get any of the other, you know, self-destruct sounds or any of that. Yeah. You know? So it's,
I mean, there were surprisingly a lot more background noises that I recognize now that I didn't remember really back then, 'cause I just wasn't paying attention to it. But I mean, they were, there was a lot more Easter eggs, I guess, there. I don't really don't want to call them Easter eggs, but there was a lot more following the guidelines, if you will, of what the Star Trek universe should sound and look like.
Right.
There was definitely more of it, with the exception of that lens flare, because of that lens flare.
Oh, yeah. So it's kind of how I was. Like, I've come to like the other three spinoffs in their own right, and I keep finding new stuff anytime I've been going through them more recently. And it's like, yeah, they all suffered from like the first 2 years kind of being chaotic on each of them. But Deep Space Nine, I really dug how everyone's kind of more like the Marines and aliens. They're all going around doing ship security and doing more just kind of stranded on planets kind of stuff. Voyager, I dug the other just kind of Borg attacks and everything, and then it just got, complaints because there were a lot of annoying holodeck scenes and just alternate timelines, and you can only have so many mutinies on a ship before it just gets stale. And Enterprise's other main issue is it also kind of came out around the same time as Nemesis, and it just felt like it was trying to imitate Star Wars while using original series sound effects. And unfortunately, I really dug the last 2 years. So if we're going with any version of Enterprise, I definitely prefer that earlier, or even some moments of Discovery over these movies. But if you want Star Trek and you want to summarize, definitely try out the first two.
Yeah, definitely worth revisiting those two, whether you've seen them or not before. I mean, if you haven't seen them, definitely do see it. Just keep in mind that it's not the same Star Trek you grew up with if you're unfamiliar with it. And then avoid Star Trek Beyond like it has COVID.
Couldn't have said it better, 'cause I see so many defend it. I'm like, but this has everything you hate in a movie. And yeah, but it was so much fun. I'm like, but why was it fun? I don't know. I'm like, okay.
Like I
Maybe
said,
you
but
should.
overall, it just cannot keep my attention, and I know people really seem to like that one for some reason. I still can't fathom why.
It's kind of like with every other post-Matrix movie. It's funny what stuff is being teased now, and some of those I still kind of like, and there's others where it's like, yeah, well, you hate it now, but you liked it then. And I could have told you just when I saw it was pretty bad because it was just monotone in story. So it is kind of interesting what stuff just evolves over time, and everyone just takes a while. It's like you don't know if they like it just because they're with a bunch of friends and were drunk. You don't know if they even know. Movie fandom is funny that way. So where can we find Track Untold for those who don't, track down anything track related on podcasts and follow your awesome interview style?
Well, for folks who don't know much about Trek Untold, too, it sounds like it might be super nerdy, super Trekkie, but we're a little bit more open-ended than that. And the show is very much about the entirety of a career of someone. So whether it's a performer, a stunt performer, a graphic designer, an editor, a VFX person, it's kind of about talking about their other projects, learning about the things that they do and how they get things done. So even if you're not like the super biggest Trek fan, you're probably going to still find a few guests that you enjoy and hear some stories you're going to like. So if you want to listen to the show, you can check it out on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Amazon Radio, pretty much anywhere where podcasts are available. And the show is also available in full video form over on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/nerdnewstoday. And if you want to follow us on social media, just look for Trek Untold at Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook.
And it's once again, it's just so cool how you got that whole you were able to keep promoting track actress Alicia Knopf's, nonprofit organization for the homeless. It's like, yeah, everybody wins when you
And
got
thank
that.
you for reminding me too. If you don't mind, I'd like to actually plug that too for folks
Please, please,
who are
please.
the internet. Lisa Naff, you might remember her from her episode of TNG. She's also in Total Recall, a bunch of other things. She was the triple-breasted mutant from Total Recall, and she runs a charity right now called Drive-By Do-Gooders, and it's really amazing. It's a registered 401c, and what she's doing is going around the really, really horrible homeless parts of LA and handing out food, water, sanitary things. She's doing a lot of real serious work out there with, no overhead whatsoever. So you can donate directly to her on her website, which is, I believe, drivebydogooders.org. You
Yes.
can also check her out on Instagram and Twitter as well. And right now, she's actually doing a really special, cool thing. So if you donate $35 or more to her, let me start that one over. If you donate $35 or more to her charity, and let her know in the comments that you're interested and you'd like an autograph, let her know what you want. If you want Star Trek, Total Recall, or anything else that she's done.
Saint Elsewhere. Which I actually saw this, you know, around the same time I heard that interview, and it was great. It's like, yeah. So it's cool to know that, you know, she's grateful for all these roles, and at the same time, you know, definitely another talent who just deserved such a bigger career than what, you know, limited roles she was given. And but how cool that she's known for just a few small guest spots in a cult movie.
And she's done so much more since then. And yeah, like I said, you know, donate $35 to the charity, she'll send you an autograph picture. You can't beat that. And by the way, folks, it's also tax deductible, so you can't beat that at all.
Right. And I mean, where else are you going to learn about someone who, again, just cares about everyday hardworking people who weren't as fortunate and who worked as an undercover journalist?
Yeah, I know. Her story is amazing. For folks who like are new to Trek Untold, I always point them at that episode because there is Trek talk, but there's so much more to it. And Lisa is one of those folks who really, like, she left Hollywood behind to basically start a whole new career as a journalist. And that picked up in some crazy ways, too, because, oh my God, she broke the Bill Cosby story. So, you know,
right?
There's a lot of bones to pick on that episode. So if you want to check out a show that, if you're not like the super big Trek fan, the Lisa Neff episode, which I think somewhere in the 30s, that's definitely a good starting point to listen.
Especially to hear her talk about dancing, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that stuff too. Yeah.
Thank you ever so much for being on here, Matthew. It was really just cool to just kind of just sum up how this has a very complex kind of fandom to it. And I think you broke the mold on, you know, everything can be enjoyed. You just got to know what mindset you want to be in before you dedicate time to these kinds of movies. So.
Very true. You know, the legacy of the Abrams films, it does continue to this day. It really changed how people look at Star Trek, their vision of Star Trek. And, you know, while Star Trek, at the end of the day, its core has always been to be a little moral lesson in every 44-minute episode, the Abrams films didn't necessarily do that, but they did kind of change it and bring it into modern times and brought Star Trek back into relevance. So we got to give some gratitude there for those movies. And they're definitely worth watching, especially through a modern lens. They still hold up. And, yeah, give them a shot.
If anything, it'll lead to just bigger and better Star Trek movies. And if we can get more Trek movies, I'm all for it.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if we're going to ever get a Star Trek 4 in the Abrams verse. I'm pretty sure we're never going to get that. But, you know, we got these three, and I'll take them. They're pretty good. I'll take them as is.
Sure. All right. You be safe out there.
All right, thank you so much for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
You owned it. Thank you.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of
They Must Be Destroyed on Sight
as needed, and let the hosts Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in
it. It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it.
I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that. Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of
it. Unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a rough
one.
How
did you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach, and we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 out. Bana 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 out.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. Where the one last plot holes are gratuitous movements. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy.
At EILFM.podbean.com.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.